Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR News and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he has no reason to suspect there's any bigger national security risk after yesterday's van attack that killed 10 and injured more than a dozen in Toronto.
The entire community of Toronto has shown strength and determination in the face of this tragedy. All Canadians stand united with Toronto today.
But while there is no link now to terrorism, Toronto police have not yet found a motive behind 25-year-old college student Alec Manassian's driving up to a mile, mowing down pedestrians, scattering baby carriages and bus shelters in his wake. Today he made his first court appearance and was charged with 10 counts of murder. The CBC's David Common joins us from Toronto. And David, police are saying this man has no police records, but are we gleaning anything from social media, Facebook, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just social media. We're able to talk to some people who have known Alec Manassian. There was a man in court this morning as he made his first appearance who seems to have been his father, crying, saying sorry very quietly to reporters. Doesn't sound like he's had the opportunity to speak with his son. But, you know, the Toronto police are saying we don't yet know the motive, but we do know some things. We know, for instance, that his Facebook profile was pulled down by the social media giant, but before it was pulled down, it included references to what's known as incel, involuntary celibate. In other words, an individual who has been rejected by women, someone who is part of a group who feels that they are owed sex, and someone who, in that same Facebook post, talked about someone in California, Elliot Roger, as a supreme gentleman. He's an individual who, in Isla Vista, California, carried out a deadly rampage that left 6 people dead, all part of this same incel group. Now, having said that, Alec Manassian, the individual we're talking about, people who know him and have known him over the years, acknowledge that he may have at the least a learning disability and some sort of further mental disability that he has dealt with for a very long time. It could be something along the lines of Asperger's, but we don't yet know that. We don't know the broader implications. We don't fully know what the motive was here. The fact that Canadian authorities are intentionally not using the word terrorism reflects the fact that the motive does not appear to have been political in nature of this individual, and certainly that he had no past calling cards or hallmarks or connections to any kind of terrorist organization. It just doesn't right. seem to be that. It, you know, many people very quickly are assuming it's that, but with the benefit of time, doesn't look like it.
Well, and this has sparked a lot of conversation about the definition of terrorism. As you just said, there's no political motivation. It did terrorize, but may not be politically connected. And a lot of people are saying, well, you know, people are wondering about his mental stability, this incel rebellion, fascinating, you know, rage at women, the same as Elliot Roger had in California. You know, but if he had been a Muslim, could he also have been mentally ill? So it's a lot of conversations.
Mm-hmm. He wasn't.
Yeah, right. And but yeah. a lot of people saying, well, wait a minute, why can't, you know, somebody who is a browner color, why can't they be classified as mentally ill? So those conversations are happening. But meanwhile, what's happening there? This is Toronto. This is Canada. You know, I'm assuming there are no barriers on streets the way there are in Times Square in New York. Are people thinking things might have to change? How are they reacting to this?
You know, certainly there are some areas. Oddly enough, only about a month ago in the downtown core, the Toronto police very abruptly instructed that barriers would be set up around the major sporting events where the Toronto Maple Leafs play, where the Toronto Raptors play, and that there would be vehicle restrictions. And the inference was to protect against this very thing, this thing that we have seen in the United States, that we've seen in Europe, where vehicles are being used as weapons. Where this took place was, by appearance, a downtown area with tall office buildings, mixed use, residential and business, a place where there is a great density of people. But it's in the north end of the city, it's sort of an uptown downtown, if you will. And we know that, of course, 10 people were killed, 13 others injured. Some of the cases, some of the examples of what happened are now coming to the fore. things like two women walking down the street after lunch and having a conversation, and then one of the women wasn't there. And the woman who was left had just felt the breeze as the van raced past her. And, of course, it was only later that she found her friend at this point, dead.
Yeah.
We know that some of the injuries of those who remain in hospital are very, very serious, that a code orange was called at the nearest trauma center, getting all staff possible into the place.
Lots of trauma in Toronto. The CBC's David Common, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Quite welcome.
Well, the White House will host the first state dinner of the Trump administration tonight in honor of French President Emmanuel Macron and his wife Brigitte Macron. President Trump and First Lady Melania welcomed them this morning. Speaking through an interpreter, President Macron said the two countries share the same goals when it comes to fighting terrorism.
France and America are both confronted to it in various forms, on our respective soils, in the Levant, or in Africa. It is together that we will counter the proliferation of arms of massive destruction, be it in North Korea or in Iran.
Well, we wanted to know how all this is playing in France. The BBC's Hugh Schofield, a veteran Europe correspondent, joins us from Paris. Hugh, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you very much.
Hugh, the French globalist who rejected nationalism and the brash America First nationalist president seem to have struck something of an unlikely alliance. What's your sense of how that friendship is going over with the French public?
It is the most unlikely of alliances. They recognize in each other these people who are not products of the political system. There's some kind of recognized, maybe sort of reflected glory that they see there. As for how it's seen in France, well, I mean, I always draw the comparison with how it's seen in Britain. I mean, in Britain, Trump seems to be hated with a much deeper visceral hatred than he is in France for some strange reason. You would think, for example, Trump was here in last July for the July the 14th Bastille Day celebrations. There weren't street protests, and I'm quite sure there would have been had he been in Britain. And my only conclusion to all of this is that in France, they don't have a special relationship with America. There hasn't been this axis like there was between Obama and Merkel, or between Blair and Clinton. And I think that allows the French a slightly greater freedom to sort of keep their distance and disapprove, but without feeling personally too offended by it all.
That's interesting. And the fact that they sort of bonded over both being political outsiders, and Trump was apparently quite taken with the Bastille Day celebration and pomp.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the big factor in all of this, of course, is the Macron charm. And Macron is an absolute genius at personal relations. His whole approach to the world and to politics and people is to say that good and bad coexist. And there is no point in joining in the bandwagon of hammering it at him. So I will exercise my charm, and I will try and influence him in that way. And that's what he's done, and he's very, very clever at it. And I think that plus the decision to put on display, invite him to the Bastille Day display with all that military pomp and so on, was a masterpiece, masterstroke, and it clearly worked.
Hugh, is Macron, though, under any pressure to show a kind of political return on investment here? I mean, what does France really gain from this closer relationship?
Well, I think that is the sort of point which people are making here, and he's sensitive to it. At his interview a week or so ago after the Syria strikes, he was at pains to say, oh, yes, I influenced President Trump and I brought him back from the edge. You know, he was going to walk away from Syria and I persuaded him not to. And then he wanted to hit Assad, all guns blazing, when I said, no, we've got to limit it to chemical targets. And this was seen as an attempt to prove just that you know, there is a dividend, there is something that comes out of being close to Trump, keeping him inside the tent, being accompanying him on his journey through modern day politics.
In a sense, he's trying to temper the president's more unrestrained instincts, kind of.
that's what he's trying to tell the French that he's doing. I mean, that I think is his rationale, that that you know it's far more dangerous to isolate Trump and leave him to be. Whether or not these dividends are real, I just don't know. I mean, we only have his word for it that he managed to persuade Trump to sort of change on Syria. And on these all these other issues, of course, I mean, the gulf that separates them is massive. And I don't think there's any huge expectation that he will affect any change, on climate, on Iran. I don't think people will really judge him on that.
And Hugh, you mentioned strikes and protests mainly over Macron's efforts to reform the country's labor laws to make it easier to hire and fire workers. Is there any big backlash on the left in France to this 3-day visit to America or not?
Not really. I mean, the political opposition here is very, very docile at the moment. It's in tatters. There is a left wing, of course, and there always will be a left wing in France, which will, you know, criticize Macron and say he's the tool of Trump. But again, I go back to what I was saying at the beginning, that accusation that you get from the left in Britain is far more easy to argue. You know, turning on the French president and saying, oh, you're the puppet of the Americans, doesn't really have the same conviction. And I think Macron can shrug that off pretty easily.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris speaking about the French president. Some are calling the Trump whisperer. Hugh, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow, an Illinois appellate court is scheduled to hear the case of a man who says shoddy analysis of a gun led to his wrongful incarceration for more than 20 years, and it could set a precedent for hundreds of other inmates. It may also force the Illinois State Police to re-examine an analysis technique used for decades to help put people behind bars. Max Green from member station WBEZ reports.
Patrick Persley was convicted of murder in 1994 and sentenced to life without parole. The linchpin of the state's case against him was ballistics testing, showing his gun had fired the bullets found at the crime scene.
I mean, I told the police so many, look, I didn't do it. I told anyone that would listen, I didn't do it.
Persley says when police picked him up, he was about 6 years out of a gang, and he had the gun for protection.
At that time, my girlfriend, she had been robbed on our doorstep, and someone put a knife to her neck.
The ballistics examiner who testified said Persley's gun was a conclusive match to the bullets found on the scene. So when Persley was sent to prison, he was focused on getting the gun retested, but he was up against an Illinois State Police policy to not retest guns.
When you come from the streets, you're not really equipped to understand procedure law and legalese, constitutional rights, etc., etc. And so from the beginning, I was in the books and ultimately wound up getting a job in the law library.
Persley says he got a reputation for being the guy to talk to if you wanted help with an appeal.
I was a jailhouse lawyer.
He also read about something he thought could help in his own case, a giant electronic gun database.
It was being used by law enforcement nationwide. And what it does, it uses algorithms to match bullets, much like DNA or fingerprint testing. I felt like this could really help me. The computer system wouldn't have a bias. This was numbers.
Persley believed the database would be more objective than the police crime lab, but there was a hitch. At the time in Illinois, inmates could only get DNA or fingerprint evidence retested. The new gun database wasn't available to them.
I wound up picking up the pen and I wrote an article, maybe three paragraph article that I wrote, and said that the law needs to keep up with the technology.
Advocates saw Persley's writing in the jailhouse newsletter Stateville Speaks and brought it to lawmakers, who adapted his argument into a bill. Under the new law, essentially crafted by Persley in prison, the gun evidence from his case was put through the database. It showed the gun was not a likely match to the bullets and cartridge casings found at the crime scene, and Illinois State Police examiners agreed to take a second look. The same examiner who said the gun was a match in 93 changed his conclusion after evaluating it again nearly two decades later.
It is like a roller coaster ride from hell. Very tumultuous. It still is. So I'm not celebrating.
That examiner now says Persley's gun probably fired the bullets, but the test results are inconclusive. The Illinois State Police refused to talk to us about this case, citing pending litigation. They also didn't answer even the most basic or general questions about ballistics evidence and how they do their work. But Jim Kreiser spent 35 years with the agency analyzing ballistics evidence before he retired. He says the process of matching a gun to a crime relies on an examiner's experience level.
What it comes down to is an examiner is trained for more than a year, often 2 years, and they go through a process where we teach them what an identification is. It is a pattern matching exercise.
Kreiser says he tested hundreds of guns a year while on the job. He says the process is basically just looking at bullets and casings, sometimes using a microscope, to compare marks a gun leaves on them, looking for patterns.
And if we find the same pattern in these marks as the marks on the evidence cartridge, we can conclude that that evidence cartridge case was fired by that particular gun.
But he says there's no minimum number of similarities or differences an examiner needs to draw a conclusion about a gun.
There is not a standard. It's a pattern recognition issue.
It's basically a guess. I'm sure there's a lot of ballistic examiners who swear by the science, but that doesn't make it scientific.
John Lovey is one of Persley's attorneys.
The scientist who testified at Patrick's trial gave testimony that left a sincere and earnest impression that it had to be Patrick's gun. That testimony was scientifically flawed. When we think of science, why do we believe science? It's not just because a guy says I'm a scientist. It's because you can replicate results with studies. Well, there's no study that corroborates that this shell casing looks like that shell casing. It's just some guy's opinion.
Kreiser disagrees. He says there's good reason to be confident in ballistics testing. He says examiners with the Illinois State Police were regularly subjected to blind tests. For example, they'd be handed a gun and several bullets and have to identify which bullets, if any, came from the gun, and the tester already knew the answer. Kreiser says he doesn't know of anyone getting the tests wrong.
If it's true that it wasn't a scientific process and that we didn't know what we were doing, how come we get all of these tests right all the time?
Persley's lawyers looked for useful precedents when they were prepping his appeal. They didn't find any cases and say his is the first in Illinois to successfully appeal based on a reexamination of this kind of ballistics evidence. Persley himself says it could open the door for hundreds of others who had similar testimony given against them by state police gun examiners.
But it's scary to think that my case represents the tip of the iceberg.
Persley's conviction was thrown out, and he's out of prison right now, but could be retried. At the hearing tomorrow, appellate judges will be considering arguments for and against the gun evidence. For Here and Now, I'm Max Green in Chicago.
Now to another court case. Boxes of documents were seized earlier this month in an FBI raid of the office and hotel room of Michael Cohen, President Trump's personal lawyer and fixer. Cohen is being investigated for potential banking and campaign finance violations. Judge Kimba Wood of the Federal District Court in Manhattan has not yet decided who will review Cohen's material. The documents are sensitive. President Trump's legal team tried to prevent the court from looking at everything, but the judge said no. And whoever gets the job of sorting through all these materials will have to determine which documents, if any, fall under what's called attorney-client privilege. If a document does fall under attorney-client privilege, it's considered confidential, it'll be given back to Michael Cohen, and will not be used in court. Stephen Gillers is a law professor at New York University. He says attorney-client privilege is a centuries-old legal standard affirmed by the Supreme Court, and he says it has a specific goal.
What it means to accomplish what the United States Supreme Court said is its purpose is to enable the client to speak candidly to his or her lawyer to provide all the information the lawyer might need so that the client can get informed legal advice. An uninformed lawyer cannot adequately inform and advise the client. And we tell the client that this information is secret and you don't have to worry about sharing it with your lawyer because your lawyer can't disclose it to anyone else.
For the person or people reviewing these Cohen documents that were seized in the raid, there are a number of things that they'll look for to see if attorney-client privilege applies. For instance, who's included in the correspondence? Explain that.
Well, the privilege will only apply if there's a correspondence or a communication between Cohen and his client or Cohen and his own lawyers. And so the first thing you look at is who was party to the communication. If Cohen is writing to his banker or his business partner about a business matter, that doesn't even cross the line into possibly being attorney-client privileged.
So if a lawyer is discussing something other than legal advice with a client, is that privileged?
Probably not. Depends upon the mix of the communication. If a communication is predominantly legal, but around the edges the lawyer gives some peripheral advice, the whole thing will be protected. But if it's predominantly non-legal advice, then none of it will be protected.
Talk a little more about the exceptions to this attorney-client privilege.
The major exception, and the one that is most fascinating here, is what's called the crime-fraud exception. What it says is if the client's purpose in communicating with a lawyer is to use the lawyer's services to advance a criminal or fraudulent goal, then the whole communication is not privileged because that is not a legitimate use of lawyer services. And so the government seems to be claiming, and successfully claimed to get its warrant in the first place, that there is reason to believe, probable cause to believe, that the purpose of some of the communications between Cohn and others was to achieve a criminal or fraudulent goal, and that therefore they are not privileged.
In response to this raid, the president tweeted, quote, attorney-client privilege is now a thing of the past, saying that he had lawyers worried about raids on their offices or homes. Does anything about the raid or the way this case is proceeding raise questions for you about attorney-client privilege?
Not at all. In fact, what's happening right now in the federal court in Manhattan is a studious effort by Judge Wood to identify those documents or communications that are privileged so that they are returned to Cohn. The whole exercise is an effort to protect the attorney-client privilege, to separate out those items that are privileged from those items that are not. If the privilege were dead, there'd be no such effort going on.
Stephen Gillers is a law professor at New York University. Stephen, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Google's parent company, Alphabet, kicked off highly anticipated earnings reports this week, yesterday announcing profits up 73% in the first quarter of 2018, most of it, nearly $27 billion, from advertising revenue. Good news for investors afraid that weeks of negative headlines about Facebook's ad practices might have put a damper on ad buys. Let's get a check-in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor at Recode. Kurt, what more did we learn from Alphabet yesterday?
Well, I think we definitely learned that there's still a strong appetite for advertising, although I think you have to remember that the Cambridge Analytica drama really happened at the very end of March, which means that almost all of Q1 was already over by the time people started freaking out about that. So most of these numbers were kind of set in stone before. But I think the big thing we took away from Google on top of the ad revenue was that its home thermostat company, Nest, they finally broke out some revenue for that, and we realized it's not a profitable company. It actually doesn't make that much money. It just kind of goes to show how hard it is to build a second business, especially a hardware business these days.
Well, you mentioned Cambridge Analytica, which, of course, was the data company that hoovered up personal information of tens of millions of Facebook users. So you're saying that this news is before that broke in the first quarter, but Facebook is set to announce its earnings on Wednesday. Will it be the same thing there? What are you expecting there?
Yeah, I think it's going to be kind of more the same for Facebook. The company usually comes out and delivers strong earnings. I mean, they're operating along with Google as one of two dominant players in this digital ad space. And again, everything that's really happened, this whole hashtag delete Facebook campaign, that all happened either at the very end of Q1 or even into Q2 here in April. So it would be more interesting actually to check back over the summer on their Q2 numbers to see if this has any serious effect on their business.
I love when you talk quarters in that way, Q1, Q2. Well, we just want to ask about the other Facebook news. Today, the company published 25 pages detailing its guidelines for policing content, nudity, violence, hate speech. You write in the past, there were just four lines, for instance, to describe how they define a direct threat. Now it's a page and a half. So they're giving more information, but does it reassure you at all?
Well, it doesn't change the way that Facebook actually monitors this stuff. What they're trying to do is give people a better understanding of what their own content moderators and employees look at when they decide whether they should take something down or not. So one of the big issues is that Facebook and other tech companies have always had these policies, but really when they decide what stays up or what comes down, you don't really have much to go on in terms of why they made those decisions. So Facebook is publishing the whole playbook. They're saying, this is exactly what we look at. Now you're in the know, and hopefully, or at least their hope is, that people are not going to be as upset or confused when the company does choose to take an action.
Right. They outline their appeals process as well. But as you point out, a lot of things can be detected by artificial intelligence. Beheadings, how awful. But hate speech, it takes people on hand scrolling down. Does Facebook have enough people to do that?
Well, it's incredibly nuanced, right? I mean, what many people might consider hate speech, other people might consider free speech, right? Which is why this is such a tough issue for any company to tackle. But, you know, Facebook has promised, hey, we're going to have more than 20,000 employees working on safety and security stuff by the end of the year. The company confirmed last week that they have 7,500 people just doing content moderation right now around the world. At the same time, Facebook has more than 2 billion right. monthly users. So you have 7,500 people trying to police 2 billion people who are posting stuff all the time. I think it's always going to be a massive challenge for them.
Kurt Wagner, senior editor of social media for Recode. Kurt, thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here Now.
Preparations continue for Friday's historic meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. It will be just the third ever meeting between the leaders of the two Koreas and the first since 2007. In fact, Kim will be the first North Korean leader to cross the border into South Korea since the end of fighting in the Korean War in 1953. Technically, that war never ended because there was just an armistice, not a peace treaty. The two men will meet in the South Korean border village of Panmunjom. Besides the Korean War, the North's nuclear program is the other big issue hanging over the meeting. And Will Ripley is CNN international correspondent. He joins us from Seoul. Will, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Eric. Pleasure to be with you.
Will, set the stage for us a little bit for Friday's meeting between Kim and South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. Expectations are pretty high on both sides, yeah?
Certainly the optics of this are going to be extraordinary, Erica. To see the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, walking across the military demarcation line at Panmunjom for the first time in history, an image that we expect to be broadcast live around the world, although probably not inside North Korea, where obviously there are 25 million people who will be greatly affected by the outcome of this, but we know that they tightly control their media. We don't know what they're going to see, but we do know that if the outcome of the summit is positive, they'll get their government spin. The rest of us will be watching and waiting for updates to see how things go. Obviously, South Korea's progressive government, they want this summit to go well. They want to tee up a summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. Its basic sole purpose is to try to set the stage for the upcoming summit with President Trump, even though we don't know a date or location or even if it's going to happen yet, although all signs are it's a pretty good chance.
Will, as you mentioned, we're not sure how the North will cover this. Is the South, are they going to run live excerpts, live coverage at all? What do we know?
We've been told by South Korea's Blue House that they will be showing key moments live, and then we'll be getting updates from the press pool throughout the day. And obviously, the ultimate goal of South Korea's President Moon Jae-in is a peace treaty with North Korea to formally end the Korean War, because as you mentioned, that armistice agreement has been in place since 1953. But in order for that to happen, there need to be discussions and there really needs to be an agreement between the United States and South Korea and North Korea. So that's why this summit is historic and hugely important. But really, the most important meeting is going to happen between President Trump and Kim Jong-un.
And it's setting the stage for that meeting. North Korea has pursued nuclear armed missiles for decades, Will, and diplomatic efforts to stop that in the past have failed. Is there any reason the world should be less skeptical this time around when we're looking at denuclearization?
I think the world should absolutely be skeptical, and the key here is going to be verification. The agreed framework in 1994 that was negotiated with the Clinton administration, that fell apart, yes, in part because North Korea was secretly enriching uranium, and it wasn't telling the world about it. But it also fell apart because the United States was late on heavy fuel shipments that were promised, and two light water reactors were never built, Also, there was no formal end of the Korean War, which was greatly disappointing to the North Koreans. So there's a real lack of trust on both sides, the United States and North Korea, going into this that they need to overcome. And the key, according to a lot of analysts I've been speaking with, is that the steps North Korea takes have to be able to be verified. So we'll get a good sense what Kim Jong-un is willing to do. I mean, he did say that he's going to continue this freeze on missile launches. He vowed to shut down the nuclear test site at Punggye-ri, although there have been some questions about whether that test site is still viable after the massive nuclear test last year that triggered a 6.3 magnitude earthquake, and it's widely believed that it triggered a secondary earthquake that might have collapsed some of those tunnels. So how much of a concession is this? Really, it's more symbolic than anything else at this point, because it wouldn't cost North Korea much money to restart nuclear tests at Punggye-ri or perhaps another test site that we don't even know about. We don't know where they have their nuclear weapons hidden. So the real factor here is going to be, is North Korea willing to destroy a significant amount of nuclear weapons? Are they willing to shut down major facilities like the Yongbyon reactor? If they're willing to take those steps, that could be acceptable to start the process of normalizing relations with North Korea, perhaps opening up the country economically and diplomatically. And there's the potential, there's great potential for a good change for the people who live in North Korea. But there's also real potential that this could all fall apart and we could go back to square one and they could go back to developing their nuclear program.
And you mentioned the North suspension of nuclear tests. Speaking of other symbolic moves, the South halted its anti-North Korean propaganda broadcasts. I mean, did the North follow suit? And is that significant or just more symbolism to help set up the meeting?
I mean, this is something that the two sides have been doing, and it's really, if you think about it, when you go to the demilitarized zone, you'll hear, you know, military music and announcements kind of blaring over from the north side. And if you're on the north side, you can hear K-pop music, news headlines playing from the south side. It's almost like the two sides taunting each other. So they shut those speakers off. You know, those speakers, those are intended largely for the soldiers stationed along the border, encouraging them to defect. And we have had some really high profile defections. I mean, one thing that's significant about the fact that Kim Jong-un is meeting in the Peace House at Panmunjom, I mean, he will be standing footsteps away from where that North Korean soldier made that dramatic escape across the border and survived multiple gunshot wounds. He was seriously injured, of course. But, you know, the fact that Kim Jong-un will be in that same location, the fact that he even agreed to go there, it shows that perhaps the North Koreans are really serious this time around, or at least serious about making it look like they're serious.
CNN international correspondent Will Ripley speaking with us from Seoul, setting up the historic North and South Korea meeting this Friday. Will, thanks very much.
Thanks, Eric.
Water managers and fire forecasters throughout the West are already sounding the alarm about low snowpack in the southern Rocky Mountains. But there's another factor that could make things even worse: dust. As Luke Runyon from member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado reports, scientists have recorded a dramatic rise in the amount of dust being deposited on snow, and it's causing a lot of problems for the water supply and more.
Jeff Derry is digging a snow pit high up in the San Juan Mountains in southwestern Colorado. Derry is director of the Center for Snow and Avalanche Studies.
See a little bit of an ice crust there.
If you dig deep enough, you see the entire winter's story. But today, we're just looking for dust.
You know, you go out and you look for it, you dig, you look around, you see what you see.
And then we see it. Barely. Think of it like the rings of a tree. About 7 inches down is a beige-colored band of dust.
Is that what you're seeing?
Yep.
That's what I'm seeing.
Uh-huh.
So why is this important? Well, eventually, this snow will melt and empty into the Colorado River watershed, which provides water for some 40 million people in the Southwest. And this tiny little strip of dust has the potential to completely upend how we manage water. Here's how it works. When there's no dust on the snow, it's brilliantly white. It reflects the sun and melts off slow and steady, like a drip from a faucet. This is what water managers love. It's predictable. But when you add in dust, the snow gets darker, and it absorbs more sunlight, meaning those drips, the runoff, speeds up. Snowpack melts from the top down, so if we run into another dust layer buried further down, the more this goes on, the more erratic the runoff becomes, making it that much harder to capture or manage. Not only does this stress out water managers, it can also upset mountain ecosystems, confuse wildlife, and potentially lengthen the wildfire season. Most of the dust comes from the desert southwest, from oil and gas drilling, cattle grazing, recreation, and residential development.
It's kind of a slow crisis. It's a slow disaster.
Rich Reynolds is an emeritus researcher with the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver. In the last 50 years, as the Sun Belt boomed, so did dust storms.
We have developed the arid southwest to the point where we have faced crises and we will continue to face crises.
And it turns out that dust is a bigger threat to snowpack than a warming climate. University of Utah hydrologist Mackenzie Skiles recently co-authored a study on this.
What we found is that it was actually dust that controlled snowmelt timing and magnitude and sort of how fast snow ran out of the mountains. As opposed to temperature, we didn't see any relationship with temperature at all.
Back in the San Juan Mountains, dust detective Jeff Derry says this area is ground zero for the dust problem.
We're located at the headwaters of four major watersheds, and our mountain systems are undergoing change on a fundamental level.
And because the mountain range is a key part of an already overtaxed Colorado River system, he says everyone in the seven states that depend on the river should be concerned. For NPR News, I'm Luke Runyon in Silverton, Colorado.
There's a new tree on the grounds at the White House, a gift of French President Macron and his wife, to commemorate the role of American troops, especially the Marines, in 1918 in World War I, when they held off the Germans in Belleau Wood, effectively preventing them from marching on Paris. It put the Marines on the map, but at a cost. Over 1,800 American troops were killed, around 8,000 more wounded there. The tree planted at the White House yesterday grew on those blood-soaked Belleau grounds. William Anderson is a retired Marine Corps colonel who's writing a battlefield guide to Belleau Wood and gives tours to Marines there. Colonel Anderson, my Marine dad is going to roll over in his grave hearing this, but previous to this battle, Marines were kind of dismissed. Someone wrote, just bellhops and stevedores?
Yeah, that's true. Prior to about 1916, the Marine Corps was a very small organization and limited to ships detachments with the Navy and several kind of expeditionary installations around the world and hadn't really involved in a major land campaign.
Right. Well, the Corps was ramped up for World War I, Marines fighting in Belleau Wood alongside the U.S. Army. And we understand famously you went forward when exhausted French troops were pulling back. Some of the iconic lines of Marine lore were shouted as they went forward. Tell us more about what they did.
The stop in the Germans, it was called kind of the Gettysburg of the war for the Americans.
The Gettysburg of the war. And we understand lines like the one from Sergeant Dan Daly, you know, come on, you sons of bitches, do you want to live forever? As he waved the Marines on me, going right at the Germans. Another Marine was reported to have said to a retreating French soldier who said, look, you know, you probably shouldn't go forward. And he said, retreat, hell, we just got here. This idea that they took it right to the Germans, marching and using their machine guns as they walked.
Yeah, they stepped out of the woods. They took terrible casualties because the Germans had plenty of time to dig into the area at Belleau Wood and cause, you know, just terrible casualties. The 6th of June was the most catastrophic day in Marine Corps history in terms of casualties up to that date. It wouldn't be until Tarawa in 1943 that the Marine Corps would experience the same level of terrible casualties.
Well, when you say, I mean, it was tip of the spear fighting.
Absolutely. Close combat, we would call it three-meter war. One particular Marine would just know what was going on around him about 3 meters. Wasn't sure who was in front of him, wasn't sure who was behind him, and especially wouldn't know who was on his flanks.
Yeah. It's been said that this battle, such a part of Marine Corps history, literally, as we said, putting him on the map, that it's almost as iconic as the flag raising at Iwo Jima.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the legends is the origin of the nickname Devil Dogs is said to have had its roots in Belleau Wood. not only did it blunt the German offensive and restore hope to exhausted allies, that the Marines were, you know, part of the American army that had come to France and they were going to fight. The Allies weren't really sure how the Americans were going to fare against these experienced German soldiers.
Yeah, but they staved them off. I mean, they staved them off from Paris. Look, you now give tours, and just for the military, at the military cemetery that is now at Belleau Wood, and you're going back for the 100th anniversary next month. What's it like to be there?
It's quite an experience. I mean, the area hasn't changed very much in 100 years. It's still a beautiful rolling, you know, countryside of the Champagne region. The wood is still there, much like it was 100 years ago. The tree lines of the forest are the same. The roads are the same. It's just a great experience to go to those places where, you know, people have, you know, distinguished themselves on the battlefield.
And how did the French receive you?
The French are, in my experience going there for over 20 years, the French cherish the memories of the 4th Marine Brigade as much as they would cherish any of their own, you know, units in the military. They come out in large numbers for the ceremonies there and on Veterans Day and Memorial Day. They're so warm and friendly, and it's almost an emotional experience for Marines to go there and then see how the French react to our presence.
Well, and now there is a tree that grew in that, as we said, blood-soaked soil here on American soil at the White House. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's just a startling tribute to Marines and, you know, great credit on the French for coming up with that idea. I mean, some guy said we got to bring something, you know, as a gift on this state visit, and for them to think of something as significant as an oak tree from Belleau Wood to me is just remarkable. And it supports what I said earlier about how much they remember and cherish that memory. Of course, you know, people who were there at the time are long gone. But you have now children in the local schools coming out and supporting the ceremonies. It's just fascinating to me.
Well, and more attention paid here. Colonel Anderson, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your father's service as well.
Ah, yes.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
Semper
thanks.
Fi.
Semper Fi. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.